Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are fears today that that BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, five times larger than initially thought, could surpass the Exxon Valdez accident in Alaska in 1989 if a newly discovered third leak isn't capped soon. And the slick could hit land by tomorrow. BP executives have tried burning some of the oil so it can harden and be removed by skimmers. Today they said they'd take help from anyone. Well, the Defense Department is considering using the military to help, and fishermen are also being rallied to form a flotilla to meet the oil as it comes in. In a couple of minutes, we're going to go to Haiti, but first we want to check in Louisiana. John Tesevich is owner of Port Sulphur Fisheries Company. They have about 4,000 acres of oyster grounds threatened by the spill. John, your sense of where we are?
We were hoping that they would be able to stem the flow and stop this from becoming, you know, something major, but it looks like it's not. It's just, 10, 15 miles from our coast as we speak, and now it's a crisis mode in dealing with the cleanup effort.
So is the thinking that, you know, fishermen like you and oyster luggers and shrimp boats would gather together and go out on a flotilla to try to meet the oil?
The fishing fleet, including the oyster vessels and shrimpers, we are making a coordinated effort now to start organizing this, and it's being accepted by the oil company, BP Oil. So we're beginning to collect information on owners and the names of vessels. The captain and the crew will have to go through a training program for dealing with hazardous materials. It can be, I think, 4 hours. But we're not ready to get out on the water yet, and that's a concern because time is of essence, and this is huge. The slick is, 100 miles wide now.
But what do you hope you can do? I know that Gulf Coast fishermen and Mark Jones, who's from Valdez, Alaska, who, of course, went through that spill in the Prince William Sound, you had a conference call earlier this week. What advice did he have for you? What is he saying you might do?
Well, Mark was involved in coordinating the Navy's effort and worked with a lot of the fishermen during the Valdez spill, and he said, the fishermen are of prime importance to get out there because they have the numbers, they have the experience, and they made a big difference. And, he had made calls to our state back even Monday and said, you need to start getting the coordination effort.
Right.
Finally, yesterday, we had the conference call and are bringing the major players and our state agencies together to begin this effort. So Mark has volunteered to fly down here and help assist. We're hoping that the company has the materials and equipment for the fishing industry to be able to use out on the waters.
Tell us about that. What are some of the things that you might do? We understand you might be laying booms to try to keep the oil at bay.
Right. They use booms. They use absorbent materials to help skim the oil off the top. And Mark was telling us how the fishermen in Alaska were actually improvising using, common stuff from the hardware store, bisqueen and logs that they had in chain to make booms when the commercially available booms weren't there. So, you have to throw everything at it.
Well, as the people in Valdez, Alaska, well know, you fishermen are on the front line and you have the highest personal and financial stake in keeping the oil away. And this is particularly important for you, we understand, this time of year for shrimpers and oystermen. What's going on with your crop?
Well, we're harvesting right now our crop from our private leases. This is the peak of our harvesting season, so it couldn't come at a worse time. And then we also, oysters are about to begin spawning in May and through June. That's our peak spawning time. So, the effects of that, if your spawning is affected by this oil, that could affect, future crops, year or two down the road.
Tell us more about that, because we understand you're concerned about your crop, but also about this ecological wake that the oil spill would leave if it reaches estuaries and marshes along the coast.
That's the problem. When it gets into our marshlands, there's no way of cleaning it up. You would start damaging the marsh grass and the roots, by stomping, walking on it, or putting any kind of chemicals to try to wash it. And once the oil gets in that, you cannot clean it up. You can't get in there with fresh water. You cannot dredge it and refill like you can a beach.
Well, John, we know you want to get back to your work. We understand in the area they're using horns and everything to try to scare away other wildlife, fish and birds. Oysters, of course, have to stay in their beds. We know you've had other smaller spills, and say even a little bit of oil, you don't want an oil in your oyster. It will taste terrible. And, of course, oil could kill the crop. Do you think that BP is doing enough to help you?
I wish they were doing more offshore. They said they're spending $6 million. To me, that's not enough.
Do you think it's already even too late? How positive do you feel that you're going to be able to, as fishermen in this flotilla, have an impact?
Well, the fishermen in the flotilla will deal with it after it comes in. It is, expected to reach shore by the mouth of the river tomorrow, and then it'll probably work its way into our bays and bayous sometime next week. But the state is prepared. The seafood industry is taking steps to make sure that our seafood is safe. The state also has told us it's not only oysters and shrimp. 400 different animal species will be affected by this. It's a tremendous impact. And it's not something that will be done and finished in a week or two. That's another thing Mark Jones told us about the Valdez spill. It's not something that just you go clean up the bay and then you're finished with it. The currents and the tides and the winds keep pushing it in and around. So it's not something that we have any experience with, but we're going to be out there and doing what we can to save our coast.
John Chesvich, he is owner of Port Sulphur Fisheries Company. He's an oyster farmer in Port Sulphur, Louisiana. John, thank you and best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
Let's turn to Haiti. Nearly 4 months after the earthquake, more than a million people are homeless and are living in hundreds of makeshift camps with hurricane season bearing down. And then there's the problem of orphans. The BBC's James Fletcher is in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. James, first of all, describe where you are.
Well, Robin, right at the moment I'm standing underneath a large wooden structure with a huge blue tarpaulin roof. This is the waiting room for the medical clinic at the Terrain Accra camp in the middle of Port-au-Prince. This is one of the larger camps in Port-au-Prince, 25,000 people here. And as you mentioned, it's one of 875 places like this. So this really is a slice of daily life for Haitians in the aftermath of the earthquake. Essentially, there are two types of accommodation. It's either a corrugated iron shack, very small. Most of them would barely fit a double bed in there, but people cram their possessions in there. I've seen televisions in them, beds, decorations. People really make them into homes. There are also shelters that are made of tarpaulins, really just stretched over wooden frames. As you go around, you see animals. I peer outside, I can see a goat grazing, I can see pigs just feeding on the rubbish that litters the ground. There are some spaces for people to gather. There's this clinic here, just by the side of this clinic. There's a small child-friendly space where children gather, they sing songs. Gradually, as time goes on, these take over the function of schools. There's also places where women can gather. There's a women's group gathering at the moment to talk about combating violence in the camps, to talk about teaching skills to women and all that sort of thing. But as you walk around, sometimes there is an assault on the senses as you cross a ditch full of sewage and refuse. But at other times, you'll walk around a corner and you'll smell somebody cooking a delicious meal. What is really interesting in some ways is the way that life really does just go on. We were here the other day and we saw a cockfight taking place. Cockfighting is very popular here in Haiti. We saw a cinema here in the camp so people can watch movies to take their minds off things for a little while. And we saw a father and son playing dominoes, the father quite aggressively teaching his son how to play dominoes well. So there are those small signs of life amidst these very difficult conditions.
James, we understand this is your fourth trip. So what kind of changes do you see?
Very little, mainly. I think I came here in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake. And so obviously the trauma of that situation, the most immediate issues have now passed. But from the time I came here, say 1 month on, there's been very little change. And an illustration perhaps of that is driving through the streets this morning, we drove past a school that had collapsed. It was a teeming mass of activity of people pulling down the rubble, but they were just doing it with their hands, essentially. Hands, maybe chisels, a crowbar or two.
Still.
But this progress is just incredibly slow.
Well, there are also questions about what happens next. We want to get to that, but we know you visited an orphanage as well, one that the BBC has been in contact with since the quake. We remember early stories about accusations of American organizations abducting Haitian orphans, but what are concerns now?
Well, it's the problem with orphans is a very difficult one. There were 300,000 orphans estimated in Haiti before the quake, and an untold number since the quake who've been orphaned. So you have a massive problem there to deal with, and in some cases they can be taken care of here, although at the orphanage yesterday we spoke to one young man who grew up in an orphanage here, and he said he would rather have been adopted overseas because the conditions in the orphanage he grew up in were very difficult. He really would rather have gone overseas, even out of his own culture, to somewhere like the United States, in order to be able to have someone that he could just call mum or dad. So it is a difficult situation. So many orphans and not the facilities here to take care of them, but there are significant concerns about taking these children overseas, very young, taking them outside of their culture, concerns about the families that they will end up in, whether they will treat them well, concerns about just with that number of orphans, whether you can properly administer a system to track them, make sure that the adoption procedures are taken care of properly and avoid the problems with people trafficking. There's also some suspicion from the Haitians. This was an interesting thing that we picked up, that people told us that Haitians themselves don't understand so much the process of adoption, the desire to adopt, and that, you know, in many cases, people adopting in foreign countries have very genuine motives and can provide very good homes for these children, but Haitians are suspicious that they may be going overseas to be used as slaves or domestic help, even to have their organs harvested. So there's that disconnect there between what Haitians think is going on and sometimes a much better reality of adoption overseas.
But James Fletcher, what happens now? The LA Times is reporting that places where Haitians are camping out, not just where you are, but schools, want to get back to their purpose. There's also tensions in stadiums, churchyards, factory lots, people who want to go back to using those for what they're purposed for. So what is the thinking about where all of these people are going to live?
Well, it's a very difficult question. The camp we're in at the moment is a spontaneous camp. It sprung up on this very quite large patch of ground, which is actually, it's called Terrain Accra because it's owned by the Accra family. They're one of the wealthiest families in Haiti, and it's at the back of their factory. And they, at this stage, are happy for them to use the land. But another camp I visited in the past was on a football field, and apparently they're very keen to get the people off that, such that they've actually shut the gates to the camp so that aid organisations can't get in, hoping that that will discourage people from living there. It's a huge problem in some camps because of the dangers. The rainy season, they've been able to move people to places outside of Port-au-Prince in terms of getting them off land that's needed for other purposes. I guess they will try a similar strategy, but that is just a massive logistical exercise. To move 5,000 people from one of the biggest camps here in Port-au-Prince took several weeks, I think. So it's, and when you're talking about a million people in total, it's just a huge logistical exercise.
The BBC's James Fletcher speaking to us from Port-au-Prince in Haiti. He's there for the BBC's World Have Your Say program. You can link to that and pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. James, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
So, where will Haitians go? Well, when we come back, economist Paul Romer says build cities for them in other countries. Also later today, why the British Prime Minister is a YouTube hit, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. As we heard just before the break, more than a million Haitians are homeless. Millions more are in dire need. Our next guest, Stanford economist Paul Romer, has an idea. Let them go to charter cities, newly built cities in other countries with new transparent rules that would attract both business and migrants. It's a modern voluntary version of what happened under imperialism in places like Hong Kong, which was set up by Britain under rules that attracted commerce and migrants from around the world and was in 1997 turned over to China, which now allows freedoms in Hong Kong it doesn't allow its own people. Romer says the need for charter cities is urgent for Haiti and plan for more than 3 billion poor people around the world who are expected to move from the country to cities, the largest migration in human history. Paul Romer, explain your vision of a charter city for Haitians.
Imagine that Brazil took a city-sized tract of land that's unoccupied there and said, we're setting this aside as a place where Haitians could come if the government in Haiti does not provide the kind of level of security that every person should be entitled to. I think that's something that Brazil might actually consider because they're the main participant in the UN force in Haiti right now. If the government in Haiti does not get to a level where it's working well, the Brazilians need to ask, what are we going to do if we have to leave and we don't want to leave the Haitian citizens exposed to bad governance?
What if the Haitians, you know, don't want to leave? I mean, does this idea of a charter city count on people who are already gone or already wandering?
The deep motivation here is to give people who are poor, who are disadvantaged, who are in very desperate circumstances more choices. But right now, many of them don't have that option. There's just no place that will take them.
You say that the most important thing is that there be rules set up. Yeah. Who sets up the rules?
Well, the rules could be set up by the countries that establish the charter. The kind of rules that will matter here are things like, is it possible for a private company to supply power? Up until very recently, it may still be true, in Haiti it was illegal for a private company to supply power. That meant that electricity was very expensive in Haiti. That meant that the garment assembly firms that used to hire Haitians in Haiti, many of them left because their operations there were not competitive. Mm-hmm. More importantly, you need rules that protect physical safety. Violence against women is a terrible problem in Haiti. They take the few garment assembly operations that are left in Haiti. Many parts of the world, those operations can run two shifts, an evening shift and a day shift. In Haiti, you can't do that because the risk of violence in the dark for people coming and going to work is too high. So the very most important rules are the ones that keep people safe.
You say that this is something that took economists a long time to understand, that it's the absence of rules in, for instance, many African countries that is the biggest problem. And it's easier to make changes in a new city than it is in the entire country, even that surrounds it, even in potentially a host country.
Yeah, that's the logic here. First, that the rules that govern how people interact with each other are very important for determining the quality of life. The second observation is it's very hard to change an existing system of rules in place with all the people that they apply to. But if you create a new place with different rules and then let people opt into those new rules, you can often make a big improvement.
What about the problem that it feels like would arise that the people who have moved to this charter city still might feel like they're part of an experiment as opposed to having ownership?
We have to be realistic about the current circumstances. So think of people where their children are at risk of getting kidnapped and they don't have safe water to drink. Of course, as we develop, as incomes grow, people will want more things that we take for granted in rich countries, like voice and participation and rule setting. But initially, many people around the world would leap at the chance to just go someplace where they could be safe and their kids could get an education and they could get a job. And if we gave them more choices, we could have these win-win opportunities where they're better off and the firms and private resources that work with them are also better off. So this is not a proposal for using charity to try and help the disadvantaged around the world. It's a proposal for giving them the opportunity to participate in win-win exchanges with the rest of the world.
Staying with Haiti, if you build even a number of charter cities, let's say, don't you then bleed Haiti?
You have to think of two issues or separate two different issues. Are we trying to help Haiti or are we trying to help the Haitians? And I think we should always focus our attention on the Haitians. Now, if the Brazilians were to say the elites in Haiti, that we're going to be here for a few years, we're going to try and set up a well-functioning democratic system that provides local security for Haitians and help Haiti. If you can't get to that point, we're going to give your citizens an option to go someplace else where they can be safe and have a job. That competitive threat, that alternative for their citizens, might actually speed up the process of movement towards better governance in Haiti.
Can you give another example of where this has happened from scratch?
Well, the term charter I took from the story of William Penn's establishment of Pennsylvania. In his charter, Penn guaranteed freedom of religion to anyone who came. So that attracted, of course, many people who were very interested in freedom of religion, and they became self-sustaining and ended up changing the world in terms of governance and religion.
But that was then. That was a wild frontier. Now, pretty much everybody's laid claim to just about every square inch.
There's lots of unoccupied land that would be the site for a new city.
Where are you thinking?
Well, I mean, the most recent example of new cities that have emerged are Dubai and then Shenzhen, just across from Hong Kong.
Right.
Dubai is an illustration of the fact that a city can grow up almost anywhere, at least on a coastal location. And even though they've had some problems, there are other cities like Abu Dhabi that are now trying similar things. And so Dubai has not only created local benefits, but also started to change governance in many other places in the Arab world.
That's Stanford economist Paul Romer talking about his idea to establish charter cities. Professor Romer, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll visit with Joe Drape of the New York Times. It's, of course, Kentucky Derby time. And still ahead today, why Joe Biden may have advice for Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Both men were caught in an open microphone, but Brown is now feeling the heat. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Charles River Apparel, over a quarter century of creating apparel for corporations and athletic teams based in New England and family-owned, on Facebook at facebook.com/Charles River Apparel. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
One of the most watched political campaigns in the country gets a whole lot more interesting later today when the Republican governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, who's now running for senator, is expected to announce that he'll skip the Republican primary and run without a party. Crist has lost the 30-point lead in the polls he had over Florida's former House Speaker, Republican Marco Rubio, who's been described as a Tea Party poster child. It's a scenario similar to the one here in Massachusetts that produced Senator Scott Brown. But as recently as last month, Tea Party activists in Florida were grumbling that Rubio wasn't their candidate, that he hadn't answered their questions on immigration. And this week, Rubio expressed concern about Arizona's tough new immigration law. Mark Caputo covers Florida politics for the Miami Herald. Mark, we know foreclosures, unemployment are huge problems in Florida, and Rubio has hammered Crist for hugging President Obama back in February when Obama went to Florida to promote the stimulus package. But how else did Charlie Crist get in this position politically?
He was lulled into a false sense of security by his poll numbers and by his inherent sense of optimism. So in the summer, when things started to go haywire, Rubio was campaigning and traveling the state, and he was racking up wins at Republican Party Executive Committee straw polls. A lot of people were upset over the Obama hug and the support of the stimulus package. Rubio parlayed this, and this is a large state. Florida is a media state, as they call it. We have 10 major media markets here. And if you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of television ads, you're going to lose. That was their conventional wisdom. But Rubio not only harnessed that voter discontent in the Republican Party, he used Twitter, he used Facebook, he really worked it hard. He used his connections through Jeb Bush, who had actually literally given him the gift of a sword at one point when Rubio was leaving as House Speaker. He put all of these things together and came up with an amazing insurgency candidacy, which turned the election on its head.
Yeah. Why does that sound familiar here in Massachusetts? And Rubio is, you know, very conservative. He has not affirmed that President Obama is an American citizen. He questions whether climate change is man-made, and he opposes the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. But what about his distancing himself from Arizona's tough immigration law? How is that going to affect the conservatives in Florida that he needs to put him over the top?
It might have somewhat of an effect more in a Republican primary, but now that Crist is not going to be in the Republican primary, probably not very much. In the end, the fastest growing voter demographic in Florida are Hispanics. So it's not wise politics in a state where Hispanics can help decide an election. Rubio was raised partly out in Las Vegas, out in Nevada. He's the son of immigrants. He's Hispanic. There are many, many people in Miami-Dade County, one of the biggest Hispanic counties in the nation. where if he said he supported this, they would certainly think twice about whether or not to support him.
Well, so now Governor Crist, again in his bid for a Senate seat, has decided to avoid what many people thought might be a thrashing by Mark Rubio in a primary and instead run in the general election without party backing and take on both Rubio, the Republican candidate, and the Democratic candidate, Congressman Kendrick Meek. What do you think his chances are in that three-way race?
His chances in the three-way race are much better than they are in the Republican primary. That's why he's doing it. The governor had chartered a poll just to make sure, and indeed it showed, according to the insiders in this campaign who are connected to him, that the governor was well within striking distance of Rubio, possibly within 5 percentage points, as an independent candidate. And other polls, Quinnipiac University, showed something rather similar. So it's a much better chance for the governor, albeit he's all in now. If he does leave the Republican primary, and if he doesn't win, the chances of him making a political comeback are exceedingly slim. But then again, the chances of Marco Rubio thrashing Charlie Crist and kicking him out effectively of the Republican Party was laughable just a few months ago.
Yeah. What do you think other states might take from this? A lot of this is uniquely Florida, but what might other states take from this in your view?
I think what this shows is this is a volatile election season, and anyone who thinks they have a pulse on what people are thinking and feeling, while they might be right in the moment, in 2 days, 2 hours, 2 weeks, or 2 months, could be completely wrong.
Mark Caputo covers Florida politics for the Miami Herald, which means it's a wild ride. Mark, thanks so much.
Sure, thanks for having us.
Okay, just ahead, we're going to take a look at another very heated election in Britain. Prime Minister Gordon Brown and his Labour Party in a very tight race. Could that gaffe he made that Brits are calling Bigotgate have an effect? That's in 30 seconds here and now. British voters will be riveted tonight as the three main candidates in next Thursday's elections meet for their final TV debate. And one of them is already knocked back on his heels. Prime Minister Gordon Brown was out campaigning earlier this week and spoke to a woman who expressed concerns about what she called all those Eastern Europeans coming in. Where are they flocking from? She asked. Brown gave a polite answer, explaining, well, British people also go to Europe, then got in his car, forgetting the Sky television microphone on his lapel was still on, and said this to an aide.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman that said she used to be a lady. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, can you say internet sensation? Gillian Duffy, the woman who was on her way to buy a loaf of bread when the encounter with the Prime Minister took place, prompted this headline in the British newspaper The Sun. Gillian only popped out for a loaf. She came back with brown toast. Michael Goldfarb is London correspondent for GlobalPost.com, a friend of Here and Now. He joins us from London. Michael, is Gordon Brown toast?
The truth was, Robin, before this, the butter was being warmed up so it would spread nice and easily. The Labour Party is running third and has been for a couple of weeks now since the first debate. This event, which is the gotcha moment of the campaign, actually isn't that big a surprise. People have long known that Gordon Brown is a bit of a bully and that, you know, he says things like this and apparently throws volcanic temper tantrums. So in some ways, I'm not sure that this is going to change people's opinions all that much.
Maybe confirm feelings that they had.
Exactly. But you know, Robin, in Britain, you don't vote for the man, you vote for the party. Sometimes party loyalties are actually stronger than personal loyalties.
Well, Michael, I want to ask you about that, because just to put it in some context for American listeners, Brown is with the more left-leaning Labour Party. It would be, in some ways, the equivalent of, let's say, President Obama making that comment in a car and fueling the anti-immigration feeling that exists in Britain the same way that it exists here.
Yes and no. Yes and no. And Robin, what does left-wing mean anymore anyway? You know, the Labour Party has really been a more centrist kind of party, you know, a triangulated Democratic Party, if you're looking for the American analogy. And I'm sure that President Obama, if he was wearing a radio microphone given to him by Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch, Sky News is owned by Rupert Murdoch, I'm sure he would make sure it was off before he said a word.
Well, we should say that for people wondering, why is he walking around with a microphone on? He was supposed to remember to turn turn it on and off as he got in and out of the car. I guess the television network was following him, but oops, he forgot to turn it off. Well, this election marks the first time there have ever been televised debates between potential prime ministers. And as you said, people do vote for the party, but these are the faces of the party. So for people who don't follow British politics, just remind us, give us a quick thumbnail of the three main candidates and their parties. We've heard of Brown and Labour. Give us the other two.
Well, David Cameron went into this election as the favourite. David Cameron is the leader of the Conservative Party, Margaret Thatcher's party. He is a young, Eton and Oxford educated toff, as they call. He's a wealthy guy, but he's done much to remake the Conservative brand. I hate using that language, but it fits in this case. He's very green, and he supports the social safety net as it exists. The other party, and this is what's made this election so incredibly interesting, are the Liberal Democrats. Now, the Liberal Democrats, for decades, have sort of been known as the nice party. And then, on the strength of his appearance in the first debate, the Liberal Democrat leader, Nick Clegg, has completely changed the game. He put his party and himself forward as plausible vote winners, plausible participants in a coalition government. And ever since then, it's been on fire over here. The amazing thing about the Liberal Democrats is that they've spent the last 75 years being like a vestigial organ, like an appendix that just kind of sits there in the body, serving no particular purpose. And now, going into tonight's third debate, it's all to play for, and there's the very real possibility that the Liberal Democrats will come second, at least in the popular vote, and may well call the shots in the negotiations that go on if there is, as all the polls indicate there will be, what we call a hung parliament.
It's like Ross Perot or Ralph Nader actually winning.
It's like Ross Perot or Ralph Nader participating in one debate and doing so well that a lot of people who thought they were cranks saying, you know, this guy could actually be a pretty decent president. A lot of people think the Lib Dems are just cranks, but then they see Nick Clegg and they say, gosh, he's no crank. And we know that their Treasury spokesman, the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesman, a man well struck in years called Vince Cable, had called the economy right from about 2003 when he said, we're living on top of a housing bubble. When it bursts, things are going to be very bad indeed. And of course, events have proved him right. And this is the crucial thing about this election, Robin, is that Britain is in not much better economic condition. In fact, it's in worse economic condition than America. And the big questions here are understood by people. Do you keep priming the pump? Do you still keep running up debt? Or with debt at 70% of gross domestic product, do you start the pain of cutting the deficit? Do you start cutting public services? Do you start raising taxes on a population that's already pretty seriously taxed? And you know, the Conservative Party is a party of tax cutting, which means they're going to have to be a party of public service cutting. The Labour Party is a party of public service preservation and tax rises, but where will those tax rises go? You can't just tax the bankers. You still won't raise enough money. And in the middle are the Lib Dems, who actually seem to have a good idea of how to steer the economy through the rapids that are still lying ahead. And they have projected themselves now into a very solid second place. It's not clear whether that'll translate into parliamentary seats, though.
And, of course, the party with the most seats is the one that actually leads.
The problem with the British voting system when you have a very strong third party showing like the Liberal Dems is that you might win a percentage of the popular vote, but if it's across the entire country, it may not actually translate into seats won. So one of the first things that Nick Clegg has said he wants, if there is a hung parliament and if a coalition is formed, is new laws on voting regulations so that something more like proportional representation becomes the law of British elections, which would completely change British politics because it would make coalition government much more likely. The British Prime Minister, it's been called an elective dictatorship. U.S. presidents can only look on in awe when they look at a prime minister's ability to move legislation through a parliament. This would change everything.
Michael Goldfarb, London correspondent for GlobalPost.com. A week from today, British voters will go to the polls. By the way, Michael's most recent book is Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. We'll link you at our website to our interview with Michael about that book. And also, to the sound from Prime Minister Gordon Brown's encounter with a voter. We'll have that there as well, hearandnow.org. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And just a quick reminder, while you're there at the website, you can always listen to our program stream live. You can download a podcast, again, hearandnow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Back in a minute with North Carolina author Ron Rash, Here and Now. Ron Rash's best-selling 2008 novel Sereno was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. It's set in 1929-30 during the Depression as North Carolina's Smoky Mountain National Park is being built. Janet Maslin says the book established Ron Rash as one of the best American novelists of his day. With Burning Bright, his new collection of short stories, Ron Rash stays in North Carolina, in the Appalachians. The title is Burning Bright, and the stories are grim. Parents exiled to a trailer because their meth-addicted son has taken over their house. A man who robs Confederate graves in order to pay his mother's hospital bills. The book opens with farmers Jacob and Edna, whose hen house, a source of desperately needed pin money during the Depression, is continually being robbed.
Jacob stood in the barn mouth and watched Edna leave the hen house. Her lips were pressed tight, which meant more eggs had been taken. He looked up at the ridge top and guessed 8 o'clock. In Boone, it'd be full morning now, but here light was still splotchy and dew damped his brogans. This cove's so damn dark a man about has to break light with a crowbar, as Daddy used to say. Edna nodded at the egg pail in her hand. Nothing under the bantam, Edna said. That's 4 days in a row. Maybe that owl rooster ain't sweet on her no more, Jacob said.
Ron Rash, reading from Hard Times, part of his new collection of short stories, Burning Bright. He joins us from the Clemson University studios. Ron, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What a world you've pulled us into, stories spanning the Civil War to present day. We understand your own family has been in this area since the 1700s, so are these people you know or imagine you know because of people you've heard of? Who are they?
I do believe that they are people in the general sense that I know the stories. Obviously, I'm a fiction writer, but certainly I work from the fabric of experience and stories I've heard and stories that I've seen.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your family. You know, whereabouts did they come from in the Carolinas?
They've lived in the Appalachians, in the area of western North Carolina since the late 1700s. So I've grown up hearing those stories generations back, and I think that's been really helpful to me as a writer to have that sense of place.
Well, and let's give another sense of the place. Your character, Jacob, again, whose wife's hens, eggs are being stolen. Can you read the paragraph where Jacob tries to lull himself to sleep at night?
Jacob closed his eyes but did not sleep. Instead, he imagined towns where hungry men hung on boxcars looking for work that couldn't be found. Shacks where families lived who didn't even have one swayback milk cow. He imagined cities where blood stained the sidewalks beneath buildings tall as ridges. He tried to imagine a place worse than where he was.
He tries to imagine a place worse than where he was. This is a, you know, the places you're describing, the places that, as you say, come from some awareness of your family living in this area, they're pretty tough.
They are, and I think my main emphasis is on what Edith Wharton called the hard considerations of the poor.
Yeah. You know, we were wondering, what other Southern writers, or writers in general, might you identify with?
Well, certainly Flannery O'Connor, and I feel like I learned a lot, obviously, from Faulkner and Cormac McCarthy.
And from your own grandfather. We understand your grandparents never had the opportunity to go to college. But even though he couldn't read, when you were 5, you asked him to read The Cat in the Hat to you. And he couldn't read, but you didn't know that. What did he do?
He took the book out and made up a story. He turned the pages, and the story was very different from the one my mother had read from the same book. And that was a wonderful moment for me. It was almost as if the words could, you know, fly up like butterflies and rearrange themselves. So I think that maybe was the beginning of my interest in the imagination and the possibilities of language. I'd like to believe that.
Yeah. These stories, though, it's not butterflies flying up. You know, as we said, it's this unrelenting grimness in the story Dead Confederates. The narrator is digging up bodies of Confederate soldiers so he can sell belt buckles and buttons to memorabilia collectors. Crystal meth weaves its way through these stories. There's one about an 11-year-old boy. Talks about how a girl in his school makes fun of him because he and his clothes smell bad. Another story, a pawn shop owner sees the addiction of his clients in the stubbed brown ruin inside their mouth. In modern day, are you seeing a lot of this crystal meth addiction?
Unfortunately, yes. As a matter of fact, in the county I'm in right now, there's been a bust every 2 weeks. That's the average, not just of people possessing it, but actual places where it's being manufactured. So it's a really terrible situation. And I think sometimes it's a little bit below the national radar because it's primarily rural areas that have suffered the most from it, not just in the Appalachians, but in the Midwest and also the Northwest.
Well, you know, and we were talking about this. We had heard that crystal meth had sort of lessened and, you know, people were switching to things like OxyContin. But you're saying in poorer rural areas, it's still a problem.
It still is. And I think partly because it's so inexpensive to make and can be made relatively simply. It's a terrible drug. And one thing I tried to do in my stories is not so much to emphasize the people taking it, but the effect on people around them, the children, and in another case, the parents, and the toll it takes there as well.
Yeah. But yet the stories are sort of languid in many ways, you know, before their sudden violence. What about your stories feel Southern to you?
I think in American literature, Southern literature, you can take this back to Poe, tends to be less hopeful in some ways. But I don't think necessarily just in a sensational sort of way. Flannery O'Connor once said that what she believed was that dramatic situations, very often even violent situations, reveal human beings. You know, they reveal their essence. And I think there's something to that. I think those dramatic moments, we get to the core of what a person is or who a person really is.
Pick one from the book.
We see that in the second story about Back of Beyond, where this pawnbroker, who in many ways is a very unsympathetic character, a character that his wife has said is incapable of love, rises to the occasion.
Well, you say incapable of love, but you also write pawnbrokers have to be sort of like emergency room workers. You know, they have to have a certain distance because who is he seeing coming in?
Yeah, he was seeing, in a sense, the worst of humanity. And I think for me, the moment in the story that's most interesting is where everything's stripped down bare. He's confronting his brother who's been made a prisoner by his nephew. His humanity comes back to him. I know my stories tend to be dark and are perceived that way. As a matter of fact, somebody said my work was implacably grim, but I really don't see it that way. I think that most of my characters are doing the best they can with the hand they've been dealt in life. And I'm not a nihilist. I think their actions are meaningful and that very often they behave nobly, very often heroically.
Well, I was just going to say, when he realizes that he has to help his brother, and he takes some action, and it's a small thing, but you realize how huge it is.
Exactly, and I think that, to me, is what short stories look for, is that one defining moment where we see the human in the singular.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is really wonderful right now, I think we're seeing a real renaissance as far as the short story in America.
Why do you think that is?
I think it may have to do with the way people live their lives now. Short stories are perfect for the kind of lives we live. For instance, if I have to go pick up my son or daughter at a soccer practice and I've got 30 minutes to kill, I can actually read an Alice Munro short story in that time.
Yeah. You wouldn't believe the places I read you.
But I find that personally exciting because I think the short story is America's great literary form. I mean, we've contributed more internationally to the short story than any other form.
Ron Rash, his new collection of short stories is Burning Bright. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you.